You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Howdy, everyone. Welcome to Luxurious Room 204. We probably should have checked it before declaring it Luxurious Room 204. For all of you who are planning on reacting later this evening in a sauna, we're in good shape for that. We've let facilities know, and we also may be trying a mass migration down to room 100.
Room 100 is much cooler. I'm not sure it's cool, and maybe a little stuffy, but it's about 30 degrees cooler than that.
So that's our first step. Follow me to room 100. Sets of texts called parallel corpora. And so the way that you translate between languages automatically is you go to someone who has a lot of texts in common. The most common one nowadays is you go to the EU Parliament, and you essentially say, let's take all the parliamentary proceedings, which have been translated into 17 different languages, let's line them up. And if we see a sentence that appears in English and it also appears in Spanish within this parliamentary corpus, we know how a professional translator has translated it. And we can build huge systems on top of a corpus like this. Okay? So within my field, there just aren't that many texts to reach from. One of the observations that's been made about the Google Books project is that you actually end up with the largest parallel corpus in the world. And so a friend of mine, a guy named Darius Šuplinskas, who's a professional Lithuanian English translator, says, Google Books has nothing to do with books, it has nothing to do with text, it's completely about translation. And he means this as a provocation. He means this kind of as a radical concept, but there's a reason to think that through. It's an enormous market. Translation, depending on who you ask, is worth anywhere from $3 to $30 billion a year. It hasn't been solved well. And as Google lines up thousands of texts in multiple different languages, they suddenly have an ability to do amazing things with them. There's other things you can do when you have tons of text. I mentioned evolution of language. If you were going to build a dictionary nowadays, one of the biggest things you would want the ability to do is take a massive collection of books in a particular language, have them sorted by the year in which they came into print, watch how words come into play over a period of time. So with something like the Google Books corpus, you end up with an amazing capability of doing lexicographic research. You end up, for people who research search engines, with the ability to do an enormous amount of research on how you retrieve documents, which is still a very big and open problem, dominated by companies like, oh, say, Google. So there's a huge resource that's being generated here, sort of independent of access to these individual texts. And all the discussion that we're having about how do you access this book, this title, or that title, who gets paid, there's a whole other set of questions that are worth putting on the table, which are basically, how do you get access to this huge set of texts and all the possibilities that come out of them? There's quite a bit that's already been discussed in the course of the settlement. There's a provision to get access to this really big corpus, but it requires a great deal of work on the part of a university to step up and essentially say, we are going to build a research center based around these questions, and we're going to make it possible to access this set of texts. So part of where I would love to go in this session is to talk through what those issues are, what we would ideally want to get out of this, what those of us who work for Harvard might practically want to do to the extent that this is useful for some of the topics on the table. Peter, on the other hand.
I'm interested in human consumption of these texts. Our topic naturally breaks into these two halves, but before I elaborate my half, I want to say I'm fascinated by this half. So if that's where we choose to go, I'm happy with that. But I want humans to be able to read these texts. One peculiarity of the settlement is that it provides for access for machines. We call it open access for machines. But it does not provide for open access for humans, and you can see why. But to go back to the opening question of the seminar, what options are there for open access within the settlement in case it's adopted, and what are the options for open access beyond the settlement if it's not adopted? There are so many options for open access if it's not adopted that maybe we can just put that to one side, unless you want to talk about open access in general, which is a huge topic. But there are some very interesting opportunities for open access within the settlement, even though they're not explicitly provided in the documents. And that could be another topic for us today. This would be consumptive research. This would be access for the sake of people who want to read the stuff. A couple of proposals have already been made, and let me just summarize some of them to give you an idea of the way people are thinking. First of all, remember that the settlement does not apply to the scans of public domain books. So the low-hanging fruit for open access would have been the public domain text, but they're really not within the scope of this discussion. So we're talking about copyrighted works that are either orphans or non-orphans. Google said in an interview with the Chronicle of Higher Education last month that for the non-orphans, when we can identify the copyright holders, it's willing to put its book scans under CC licenses, Creative Commons licenses, if the copyright holder consents. Now, of course, that only applies to the non-orphans where we can ask the copyright holder whether they consent. But that's an opportunity that I don't think most people were aware of. I wasn't aware of it until that interview. Now, I'm a copyright holder. I have some books in the system. I don't know yet how to tell Google that I consent or that even that I request a CC license for this, but it's a nice opportunity. If the settlement is adopted, there should be some way for Google to ask authors whether they give consent to this, and then which of the CC licenses they want to put on their work. I'm going to try to follow that up, at least for my own, and then if I can succeed at doing that, I can tell others how it's done. But all the other options have to pertain to the orphan works. There's the Open Access Trust, which I thought would have been mentioned this morning, because Lewis Hyde is one of the people with his name on it. Charlie Nelson is the main name, and he wasn't here this morning. But we were talking about what do you do with the money generated from selling access to these orphan works, which is what Google will be doing. You can't give it to the actual authors because they're unavailable. So it's being given to authors who had nothing to do with these books. It's being given to those who are administering the fund. And what else could we do with it? Charlie Nelson and others have proposed that some fraction of that revenue be set aside for an open access trust, which would be spent to fund truly open access works. So these would not be available under the settlement, but the settlement would throw off money that would support open access elsewhere. As a matter of fact, the Open Access Trust has already been incorporated under Massachusetts law. It's ready to go as soon as it can be worked into the framework. Right now, all the money is being diverted somewhere else, so we would have to get the agreement of the parties or the judge to divert some of the money in this direction. Another proposal from Peter Eckersley at the EFF is to take the Google scanned books, and after some period of time, he proposes 14 years, the founder's copyright, those scans would enter the, at least would be online open access. They wouldn't enter the public domain because they're still scans of orphan works and they're still under copyright. But Google deserves some limited period of time to have exclusive rights to monetize them because it did the digitizing, because it took the risk of being sued, because it took the initiative. But it doesn't deserve to have exclusive access to these texts forever. Moreover, it's really not realistic to expect anybody to come along and do the job again, even though it's not exclusive and everybody has the right to come along and do the job again. It's such a big job that almost nobody will. And that's the point of my question this morning about whether we can persuade public institutions that it's not too late. Once Google digitizes 15 million books, who's really going to come back and digitize 15 million books again? So, if it's not repeatable in practice, even though everyone has the right to repeat it, and if Google doesn't really have the status of the party that deserves to hold these exclusively forever, then let's give it a period of time and then transition these files into open access. We treat them as if they're in the public domain. We're still willing to take them down if the copyright holder steps forward. And it doesn't have to be 14 years. Actually, I heard people propose much shorter times for that. But let's talk about how long it could be. The Wellcome Trust digitizes public domain works. Orphan works. And it puts them online, open access, without any formality whatsoever, without any delay. All it does is to offer to take them down if the copyright holder showed up. In other words, it's taking the risk. Yes, you can sue us, but you probably won't because we're a charity. We're putting these up because we don't know who the copyright holders are. We're thinking we're going to benefit the public while we're waiting for the copyright holders to show up, and we will instantly take it down if you do show up. Question, could Google do that? Google's not a charity. Would it attract lawsuits that the Wellcome Trust would not attract? Almost certainly. What would it take to tempt Google to take that solution. I think Google could be tempted if we had a good orphan rights bill in Congress to protect Google the way charities are protected. But we don't have that, so that's another option. And this morning I heard Jim Brimelman talk about another option. If the copyright holder doesn't step forward for a period of years, you said five, then we treat the works as if they're in the public domain. We put the files online, open access, and we refund the money to the people who paid in the first place. That's not built into the settlement, but it could be if we wanted it to be. I'll stop there just so we can open the conversation. But just to recap, the two tabs of the topic are open access for human consumption, open access for machine consumption, or non-consumptive research.
It sounds like you're really excited by the possibility of getting this interpreted.
I think anyone who's doing large-scale text research gets all hot and bothered when a lot of people put a lot of digital text in the same place. Let me give you just sort of another example of a solution that people are coming up with that may be easier to get your heads around. Has anyone run into Aaron McKean? Aaron McKean has been sort of single-handedly leading a campaign to get lexicography to be more sexy. So she's a librarian and a lexicographer and a blogger, and she's been spending a lot of time on a new project called WordNIC. And WordNIC is a new form of dictionary which essentially says we could build much bigger and possibly better dictionaries if we give up defining words. And she ends up saying that definitions are a weird form of haiku. Let go of them. What you actually want to see is something in context dozens or maybe hundreds of times. So WordNIC goes out there, it looks for unique appearances of words, and it then shows you how those words show up in context, and you can intuit a definition based on how it shows up. And if it's an older word, they're using a dictionary that is now out of copyright, and you can lean to it. But for some of these words, the context that they're coming up with is Twitter. You know, how does this come up in someone's tweets, for instance? One of the crazy things about this is that she is desperate to find texts. And when she started doing this, one of the first things she started doing was using a corpus of science fiction which had been scanned and put online in Usenet in the 1980s. And so what this meant was that for the first year of the project, when you looked up photon, all the mentions were about photon torpedoes, because there were hundreds of Star Trek novels, but no actual physics books in there. So you look at something like that and you essentially say, what if you had the ability to pull out sentences from the entirety of all the books that Google has scanned so far? You can't reconstruct a page. You can't, you know, read the page unless you have other authorized ways to get to it. But you could build a really fascinating proto-dictionary around this. So there are going to be hundreds of projects around this. As I understand the settlement, and let me be clear, I am not a lawyer, and I am also not actually all that closely acquainted with the settlement. I've simply talked to some Google people about it. My understanding is that there's a clause for non-consumptive use. As we're understanding non-consumptive use, this basically means, can you use these texts in a different way than you would as a reader? So not having the ability to pull out a page or a section or a chapter, but being able to pull out perhaps much smaller uses like a sentence, or what for computer scientists might be something as simple as word vectors. How many times does a word appear within a text? Yep.
I have a question about that, and James is here in the room, so if we need a lawyer, we can go over there. But I'm familiar with Bill Shillett's work in the Google Research Group, where he has been mining the corpus to follow the history of ideas. So he'll locate an idea and then map out in how many books that idea appears, and you can actually click through books where this idea is, you know, maybe it first appeared in 1780, and now he's following how many times it appears and in what context it appears, and that's all very interesting. What I still am not sure I get is, and I pulled up this paragraph here, which of course just disappeared, use of data extracted from specific books within the research corpus to provide services to the public or a third party that compete with services offered by the rights holder of those books or by Google is prohibited.
Yeah.
So does that not mean that you can't create a quote history idea flow service that you would want to use in some way? And my question is, it's so mouthwatering to have this corpus there.
Yep.
And I agree, the possibilities are endless. We don't even know what they are. But did the settlement just nip that in the bud beforehand by determining that there won't be commercial use or that there can't be really innovative services developed?
So let me try to give the answer that Alex McGillivray, who was one of the main lawyers at Google negotiating the settlement, gave when he came and talked to Berkman 2 weeks ago, which was, no, the goal is to allow people to come up with competitive, innovative services around the non-consumptive uses. I don't know what to tell you on that. And all I can do is tell you what he said. What he said was, the strategy of the settlement was to say, we can't just put the corpus out there and essentially say, here, have a corpus, because then it's pretty easy to sit down and reconstruct the world's digital library and release it on BitTorrent and hand it out to folks. What you can do is put responsibility for access to that corpus in the hands of a university research center. And the idea was that participating universities get the ability to build two of these research centers. Those research centers have access to the full corpus. As we push them on it, access doesn't sound like they hand it to you on a stack of DVDs. It sounds like what you can do is run queries against it. But access to the corpus for non-consumptive innovative uses, and Google does not end up owning the IP. We raised several scenarios to him. We raised the machine translation scenario. We raised the lexicographic scenario that I just put out. He said those are allowable. Beyond that, document search. An innovative algorithm for document search is absolutely something you should be able to do in this context.
Well, I thought that would be covered by even just the, you know, the term non-consumptive research, if that's well defined, would clearly limit being able to come in and copy the whole corpus. And and creating services that are, I'm just stuck on this.
Yeah.
Let me kind of sketch some of the structure of this in the settlement. They define non-consumptive research as, I can put it exactly, research in which computational analysis is performed on one or more books, but not research in which a researcher reads or displays substantial portions of a book to understand the intellectual content presented within the book. So the machines can do anything, but the people can't look at more than short parts of the book with the goal of actually learning anything from the book. When they then set up, they have two universities that host this corpus, and you could do various things against it. And I think the idea is that it's some kind of, you submit stuff to it. And I would almost be amused if Google let you run MapReduce things against it. That when you have that, you get certain things out of the result of your algorithms. Google definitely prohibits you from having a business that people ask questions of, and you cut your question over to the research corpus, query it, and come back and answer the question. That's out. They also are trying to prevent you from being able, not just legally, but physically able, to go to the corpus, copy out everything, and go, you know, send the data off to some other country and someone you have the competing complete collection of all English literature. It is okay to do some stuff and to conclude that the word consumptive has changed in meaning in the following ways over the last three centuries. That classic scholarly research. It's also okay to, in the process of doing that research, develop better algorithms for doing text retrieval, machine translation, following information through it. Those can be published, and you can even use those algorithms commercially if they've been developed through scholarly research. You can't set up a system in which you go into this and extract, let's say, lots of other facts about the English language and its history and use that to compete with Google. So you could not, having written your algorithm that does something better, then train that algorithm up against the research corpus and get, you know, a 12 million, you know, 12 million entry vector about English frequencies and occurrences, and then start using that in a commercial product. That's my understanding of the lines they're drawing.
Just to understand that, do you think they are defining fair use in a more restrictive way by defining what consumptive means?
Oh, absolutely. I would say it this way, which is that non-consumptive research is, I would think, fair use almost completely across the board.
Exactly.
So that this is a contractual set of restrictions that are meant a little bit to prevent secondary infringement because people who are allowed to make these accesses could copy the whole thing and do consumptive work. But 95% of it is to protect Google's interests through a contract of something they could not get through
copyright. But how can they enforce that towards librarians or even librarians from foreign countries if they are not part of the contract?
They get this by forcing the universities to do this for them. The two universities are bound by this agreement. They'll sign something that you don't let Google take the building if they violate the agreement. And then the universities are required, when they vet your research project, you say, I want to do research, you bring in your proposal. And their IRB or the equivalent says, okay, this looks good. Now sign here, promising that you won't do X, Y, and Z. And the universities will not sign those agreements with anybody who is not both willing to abide by those conditions and would actually respect it.
And this actually, so this is one of the questions that's come up around this. First, let me just push back slightly on fair use, right? Which is, the legal response to this tends to be to say, well, this is crazy, no one should ever sign on to this, fair use gets you all these rights, why would you ever agree to a reduced set of rights? Let me come back to you as a computer scientist. This is roughly 1,000 to 10,000 times better than anything I have access to, period. And the things that I have access to have other onerous restrictions on them in many cases, don't solve a lot of problems that would be solvable in this case. So as a CS researcher, I want this. The way that universities are talking about structuring this is that it's not necessarily just your researchers. You can designate someone else who researches against that corpus. This could be people who have some loose academic affiliation, who you know at a certain point are going to go off and try to monetize an algorithm coming out of it. They simply have to make it through that vetting process, which in its simplest form may be as simple as, are you going to release whole texts out into the wild? No, you're not. One of the questions that comes out of that is, where does the liability come on for that? If I were Harvard and running one of these centers, my inclination, if Google could sue me for my buildings, might be to ensure that I'm a full tenured professor and not as crazy as I currently am before I give me research access to this, which actually is going to radically constrain the access to these sort of corpora. One of the questions that we raised with Alex, which he was not willing to answer, was couldn't we put in some liability clauses here where the liability ends up on the researcher rather than the university in the hopes that a broader set of people would end up using it? He wouldn't address that question.
One more note about fair use before we change the subject. Fair use gives you use rights to works when you already have access. It doesn't give you access. So Google is offering you access with limited rights, and fair use would not cover that because it wouldn't give you access in the first place. If you already had access, you wouldn't have to sign the contract. That's true.
But why is it in there anyway? Why is it even in the settlement?
In a sense, because they're making something even better available. Google's in this for the search revenue and for the selling books. But they've got this thing now, which is useful. So it's here's a byproduct that has some value, and they can release. I can also imagine Google having created this space in which you can't do commercial research, coming to an arrangement where they start to sell companies access to that research and treat it as a revenue stream.
So is there anything in the settlement language that would require those two universities to allow other universities in, or could they choose that, gee, there's too much liability and we'll just keep it for just Harvard or whatever?
No, it describes the process by which you get permission.
The two universities are obligated to vet other universities?
Well, they're unspecified, but there's a process by which you have to get permission, which people think is too onerous, but Google says it's so much easier than if you wanted to do work at a supercomputer.
The theory is what they're trying to... So my understanding of it is that the university's responsibility is to vet the research that's coming in. Whether or not that has to be Harvard-certified research, whereas if I'm a qualified researcher from North Podunk and I want to do this work, do I need a Harvard sponsor for that? That I was not able to get a clear answer.
No, I just mean, do you have to vet other universities?
You don't actually vet universities.
Researchers at other universities have to be part of the process, or could Harvard decide that was too much liability and they only want Harvard researchers to use the
corpus? A host site may deny qualified users access to the research corpus at its reasonable discretion.
So there it is, at discretion. Right. Okay, yeah. So they could decide Harvard.
That's right, that's right. So the question becomes, is that too onerous? Is there a way that you would structure liability around it so that other people get different access to it? Let me just say that this is a real question even if the settlement doesn't go through. No matter what happens, Harvard has access to the corpus that's been scanned. That is by itself an enormous, enormous research resource. And I don't know what the status is of access for researchers at this institution or other institutions to that digital corpus. But in sort of thinking about what a university would do around this, it's actually in some ways easy to think about this just in terms of, what if we only got a tenth of it? That's still, you know, 1,000 times bigger than anything else we have. If you were a researcher wanting to work on this, one of the first things you would start doing is saying, I want to tackle one of the problems I'm interested in. So maybe I'm interested in Aaron McKean's dictionary problem. If I'm running queries against Harvard's resources, what am I getting as far as doing sentences with appearances of individual words? Is that massively better than what Aaron's currently been able to do? If so, can I get papers out of that? If so, how would I get Harvard to start doing that? And that might be a way to essentially ease into this larger question of how do you get access to this larger corpus. I do think what's interesting is that one of the things that sort of comes up in this discussion is, why would you want to sign on to this? You know, aren't you essentially just playing into the game? In some ways, I'm sort of saying, you can even take that off the table. There's still a fun open question for researchers, which is that even just based on having access to that corpus, which we own as Harvard, we now have the opportunity to do a whole bunch of stuff that we couldn't do previously. We need to figure out how people get access to that, how people work against that. You know, I don't know what our liability situation would be if we made that downloadable for any researcher anywhere in the world. I don't know what the implications would be on that. I would turn to our legal experts on that one.
Could you clarify something? You said you have access to the corpus no matter what happens with the settlement. Does that mean all the Google partners have that access no matter what?
My understanding...
The whole corpus, not just...
No, sorry. Documents that you submitted.
Okay.
So the theory would be, no matter where the settlement goes, Harvard should have access to the digitized copy of Harvard's resources.
Yeah, we can take that one step further. If the settlement does not go through, not only will Harvard still have access to its own corpus, but Google will have access to the total corpus. And therefore, Google will use it for the purposes you're talking about internally. Google has its own translation service, for example, and it plans to use Parallel Corpora, even if it's not the correct method. So we will be developing this using the same resource. And it might think it's harmless to allow others to use it, too. So even if the settlement doesn't go through, it may allow researchers to have access under the right conditions. So we could still ask, under what conditions, or how do we ask, or what would we like to get from Google, even if the settlement didn't go through?
It strikes me as also possible that Google may allow that, even if the settlement goes through, and that the research corpus is there as a way of helping prove that the research will not be completely controlled by Google. That they're going to turn it over to some universities who will presumably apply their standards of academic integrity to deciding who runs it.
This is a field in which universities tend to do better research than professional organizations. There just hasn't been a ton of innovation coming out of Sistran and some of the other firms there. This stuff tends to be done at the university level.
The research, yes, but not providing access. I know Harvard, and the fears of liability will prevent you from making this available to anybody except Harvard researchers.
With you entirely. Kind of trying to address a slightly different question,
okay,
which is why Google might do this.
Yep.
Assume the settlement doesn't go through. Google might still want to vet individual computer science departments that they know well, have good relationships with, because this is how you generate the next set of PhDs that you're going to hire.
Right.
So I suspect this is likely to become available in almost any setting, one of the questions then becomes, is this actually a really bad way to get access to this? You know, so as much as you may have hungry researchers like me essentially saying, please let me loose on this as soon as possible. So I mean, I think one of those questions is just based on the corpus that we know we own, which is to say the collected Harvard works. Who are we giving access to? How are we vetting based on that? Is it Harvard only? How do we get through that? How broad or how narrow are we likely to make this? And also, who's making that decision?
So what rights do you have to your subset of the complete corpus for non-consumptive use under the original contract with Google, not the settlement?
Do you know the library agreements?
Yeah. What can they do with it?
But aren't they just public domain books that Harvard did?
If it's just public domain, then one would assume that you have...
Yes, that's a good point.
You know, yeah. And no, basically no liability, correct?
Google can still try to limit your rights by contract. And
well, that's why I
would sign up for the contract. You have the problem then that if one of the public domain digital files escapes from Harvard's control and ends up in the hands of a non-party to that contract, it's a public domain digital file, and somebody can make any use of it they want. But Harvard has decided not to let that happen because it signed the contract, which probably includes
sanctions. Well, they have said that they want to make a public domain research corpus, that they want to donate that to the world. And it does make me wonder, there are so many public domain digitized texts out there. Why is there so little for you to work with?
There aren't that many.
There aren't that many.
Well, there's a million and a half, at least.
Where?
The Internet Archive. 700,000 of which have come from Google. But have been downloaded and uploaded.
I think half a million is closer to the number of actual open public domain texts.
There, it's all there. And that, even if you're rebooted back to Google, it's still on the archive servers. So there's a lot of text out there. I don't know everyone's waiting for Google.
And that's been downloaded by UMass here. Mm-hmm. And they're already doing the way you do a million book stuff on that. But I think this highlights the orphans problem again. Because again, you have this privately legislated solution for the orphans. So yes, it's possible the Internet Archive has this great repository and people have come in and pulled the stuff back. I think the UMass people just pulled back the text. They didn't pull back, you know. So they're churning through it, but they come to a screeching halt in 1923.
So,
well, I think there, for these kind of researchers, there is a big difference between 1 million and 15 million, or even 10 million, whatever their subset is. It's statistically...
I mean, for the stuff that I want to do, actually 1923 isn't useful, right? So I need as close to contemporary as possible. But it is a good question to ask, and you know, part of this is sort of figuring out what's out there, and also part of this is figuring out how do you get it into a collection and make it accessible. One of the things that's being promised in the settlement is this all in a place with some of the transformations that make it possible to do rapid searches against it possible. So our colleague referred to MapReduce, which is an algorithm used to allow massive searches against text. That's something that Google has done an enormous amount of work on. So that there is a value add that's being talked about in the construction of some of these corpora. And I do think what you're seeing is groups of people sort of finding ways to get access to more and more of these. What's being held out as sort of the holy grail is to the extent that book search includes not only public domain, but also orphan, but also licensed copyright books. Once you introduce that into it, then it starts getting very interesting for my purposes, right? So if I'm doing linguistic evolution over time, or if I'm doing, you know, essentially identification of people who are bringing out key ideas or memes, being able to get within that copyrighted material becomes critical. The reason I raise it in terms of Harvard has access to this, needs to figure out what to do with it, is that it seems like an easy way to sort of dip our toes in the water and start sort of thinking through this. If Harvard stuff is all the public domain stuff, then there's very little liability other than the contract liability, which literally comes down to what's the scanning agreement between Google and Harvard at that point. But there isn't the larger copyright liability.
But when you anticipate fears from Harvard about sharing, allowing other researchers to use this corpus, the fear of liability would be copyright liability?
It's the terms of the settlement, as far as I understand it, were that there's pretty severe liability put on the hosting institution if they let a researcher in the door and that researcher does something bad.
But those liabilities are copyright liabilities.
Well, they're financial liabilities to the hosting institution. So if Stanford did it, say, and I came in and did something that totally violates not just copyright, but the settlement terms, then...
The settlement doesn't have that much to say.
Well, the settlement doesn't talk about... The settlement covers what anybody can do with this stuff, in addition to copyright law, I would say, right?
Yeah, no, for example, exactly this discussion of what you can do in terms of commercial use.
Yeah.
Later. So if,
right.
If a researcher from Japan can come, get everything, and go to Japan and form something that's directly competing, yeah, Harvard's going to be responsible.
Harvard's liable, not Google, not you. Yeah. And I was thinking about things like the Concept Web Alliance and how useful this corpus would be to, you know, adding more data to that. But it sounds like it would be, you know, it's quasi-commercial, it's a nonprofit, but they'll be selling parts of this services on top of it. And so if I were Harvard, I'd say not a chance. You know, there's too much chance that Google will decide that this violates the contract and your building is theirs.
Off topic almost. How does the decision get made who the two are? Like, yeah. Everyone assumed it was
Google decides.
Everyone assumed it was always, you know, Michigan.
And is it two in total or is it two per participating
two plus
university?
Google.
It's two total.
Two total.
Yeah.
So it's a battle royale to the death.
Everybody's putting their hands up too.
He's not defined in a way such that it's only one researcher is allowed in there within a time. It seems quite good that this is a thing that could be presumably hit by a lot of different researchers working at once.
Yeah, I mean, the understanding is that they're essentially constructing a web service. And the way in which they're doing this is that they're controlling access to the key. And that, you know, a researcher like me might not be physically located at Harvard, but if I had the Harvard key, I could put the Harvard key on it. And if there's a release associated with it, it's associated with the key in one fashion or another. So the question then becomes, in some ways, this is a very classic Google strategy. Google hates to do careful manual review, right? We as Berkman have been involved for a while with their system that flags sites as containing malware. So you get that notice essentially saying, we're not going to let you click through to this site because we think it's going to download and put something nasty on your machine. Google has algorithms that detect sites that they think are the nasty ones. It was, for at least a year, our pleasure and chore to deal with all those complaints that come in from that system, because that's what Google loathes doing. So perhaps the most innocent way you can look at this is to say, well, Google doesn't really want to look at every single research application that comes in to look at this. Let's outsource that to a university that can do that work. It's maybe the most charitable way of looking at it. But if you're only going to do two of these, you obviously have to construct some sort of methodology so that the future of text research doesn't, you know, occur only at Michigan and whatever other institution, or from whoever else is able to manufacture something out of what's available with the Internet Archive, with the understanding of the limitations that comes into play there.
With that point in mind, that the Hockey Trust looked at offering such a service? Rather than having this caught up in Google picking two universities? And
well, that's why it boils down to what the original contracts were at pre-settlement, which I know
their contracts fall under that as well, that's right.
Right, it's whatever you agreed to.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Michigan's is publicly available, I don't know.
But Michigan's has also been enhanced recently to give it more rights.
Okay, so it could be that if you're Michigan or California or one of the state universities who managed to negotiate better terms, then you could do it. Yeah, big help.
So is there a tangible takeaway out of this? I mean, is there something that one would want to do? I mean, for me, every time I talk about this, I end up with more concerns, right? So the concern that sort of comes out around this is that, for me, the holy grail within this is the translation stuff. And you can do some of it with the public domain material, but the really amazing stuff is a publisher who's got copyrighted works, contemporary copyrighted works that have been translated into multiple languages. If someone is taking Clay Shirky's Here Comes Everybody, which has been translated by professionals into 15 languages, and that suddenly is usable as raw material along with whatever other tech books have recently come into play, the idea that we might have a much better English-Arabic translation engine based on the fact that we now have colloquial usage of those terms, that's the sort of thing that makes researchers salivate. Salivate not just because it's a fun computational problem, but also because that's worth a ton of money.
Doesn't Google have first right of refusal for the research results in that settlement?
That's what gets really challenging, because certainly under the clause that you were citing before, that seems like an extremely competitive use there. If I'm releasing a better Arabic English search engine, which wouldn't be hard, that's going to compete with what they're producing at this point.
Right.
So at that point, you know, do you have the danger of essentially closing off the entire information indexing and translation fields? Which they seem to be trying very hard to reassure people in one-on-one interviews is not the case. But short of going in and raiding our friend's session next door, it seems like that's kind of hard to answer, unless we can sort of answer it kind of in the text.
I would just add, too, that I think there's so many fields that are interested in this kind of effort that talking about it in terms of translation and computer science is, in a way, it can be too narrow. We have political science and economists in particular, I know, on our campus that really eager for this kind of access and banging up against the walls of licensed resources for years and trying to do the project. So I think it's a huge area of great concern at universities. So I just hope we don't end up with a model which is too, two universities that are too scared legally to allow others in.
Can you outline what one of those poli-sci economic projects would look like?
In particular, I can think of one professor who is looking at the occurrence of words in relation to outcomes of elections. Mm-hmm. So once again, I suppose you could be looking at historical elections, but he was looking at more current ones. So do these words appear in certain types of sources with certain publishers, and then what happened over here with election results? That was one study.
Yeah, absolutely.
And wanted massive amounts of text, didn't want to read them, but just wants to count occurrences in certain publications.
And this question in general about how fair use comes into this is going to come to the fore at some point fairly soon. One of the projects that I'm leading over at Berkman right now is called Media Cloud. And Media Cloud goes out and subscribes to a couple thousand newspapers and a couple thousand blogs. And it gets the full text of these stories and stores it. So we're doing all sorts of violations of terms of use there by automatically collecting this text. What we're then doing is making it possible for people to sort of search through and find out what words were common or less common. So we're interested in questions like, when did it stop being a stimulus and when did it become a bailout? And how did that change happen? And so we can actually look at those words over time and try to figure out, can you isolate to the articles where that sort of change in valence came out? We've had this up, no one's come after us. We now want to go a step further, which is we want to release this information. We know that we can't just hand over the database, because you can use the database to reconstruct the New York Times for the last 2 years and put your own ads on it and sell it. So that's probably not going to work. But what might work, we think, is word vectors. You can get most of the stuff out of this by saying, here was the story, here's the URL of the story, here's what words appeared in it, here's the frequency that they appeared with. Peter was pointing out to me earlier today that Nature now has a format that has not only those word vectors, but some adjacency information, which is really helpful. What happens if I release that and let people go out and non-consumptive use, right? You're not going to go reconstruct the New York Times from it. You can't read the data that I'm putting out and essentially say Obama 23, Biden 13, and say that you've, you know, gotten the gist of the article. But it's incredibly useful for certain types of research. Is that going to be considered academic fair use? We think it's a transformative work. Because we're a university putting this out for free, we don't think that there's going to be a fiscal implication associated with it. We think it passes a four factors test pretty cleanly. But what I think isn't going to matter. What's going to matter is whether Berkman and Harvard as a whole get sued for this and whether we have to cease and desist from doing this. So whether or not this comes up in Google, this larger question of what are the rights to essentially non-consumptive information within a collection of texts is going to come up in a big way at some point soon.
Here's a related question. Those issues come up because you're actually harvesting the full text and storing them offline, running your own searches. And if anything violates terms of use, that's what it does. The question is whether you can do similar text analysis without harvesting the text and storing them. If you had permission, to get your queries in there. And maybe for some purposes it would be enough if you could just get your queries in and you wouldn't need access to the full text. If true, that is, if the host could technically restrict you from copying full text and then reusing full text, big if perhaps, then I see no reason why they shouldn't consent to research analysis of their text, even if they're still under copyright. And if so, we could persuade others the way nature's been persuaded, that text mining is a useful and harmless service that they can offer without losing any money and without changing their business model. But that presupposes that there's not going to be a technical arms race here, and by permitting your queries in, they're not going to be trying to deal with BitTorrent next week.
I mean, the other fear for me on this one, Peter, is that I'm not just trying to persuade the New York Times. I'm trying to persuade, you know, the Podunk Post, and even more challenging than I'm trying to persuade all Nigerian newspapers to do this as well. Because my, you know, I'm an Africanist, and what I'm specifically interested in is how media discourse between citizen media and professional media is different from different countries. So in some ways, the nature example for me sort of scares me a bit, right? Because here's an incredibly smart, cautious publication essentially saying, okay, we get it, you know, text analysis, it's a good thing, it's an important thing, we don't want to stop it. We just want to make it incredibly hard, and we'll simply hand you a resource to let you do what's currently useful as far as text analysis. Possible that those algorithms may change over time. It may turn out that word vectoring, you know, plus adjacency isn't actually that helpful. It may turn out that, you know, sentence length turns out to be incredibly important as far as figuring out authorship or content similarity. If it's not in the format, we don't get access to it. So, I mean, I think this is one of these places where the reason we're hoping to do this is A, because we've provided a useful service, and B, because it's a fun line in the sand to draw. And essentially say, it's really not possible, based on what we release, to reconstruct the original out of all of this. It's not a Google News example, because we're not putting up a paragraph and potentially monetizing it. We're giving you something that just simply isn't human readable, but has a real utility independent of the article. We believe that should be fair use, and, you know, to a certain extent, that would be a fun fight to end up in if we end up getting a cease and desist around
it. This is kind of a little bit more topic, but I always understood that one thing about research is verifiability. So you have the ability to go and run your thing, but it's by permission.
Yep.
So the next person who comes after wants to verify. You know, it feels like the Elgin Marbles to me. I mean, you're sort of, you're at Harvard, you know, you're sort of close to the
people who open the gate.
It feels a little like we're drastically changing the ecology of what it is to do research if it becomes by permission to re-verify.
That makes the link that disappears.
When we released this toolkit for Media Cloud, the Media Cloud code is out there. So far, we've built the Media Cloud system around a published list of sources. It's very hard for you to go back in time and recreate what we've done, although since we've got all the URLs, you can theoretically go back and do it as long as they haven't changed. But you can certainly reconstruct the system and run it forward. One of the decisions we had to make is that the best source of English language blogs out there right now is a commercial company called Spinner. And it would have been very easy for us to spend $5,000, license their collection, get access to it. But then that becomes a barrier to anyone else essentially attempting to do it. Similarly, we didn't go to the Wall Street Journal and ask for a special Harvard research exemption to spider their content because it becomes irreproducible for someone else. And you're absolutely right. This is what we're talking about within the context of these. You can imagine a scenario in which access to these collections is so broad that it becomes the default within the field, much as currently people use the Your Parl set to do machine translation. And so many people have access to it that it's simply the new default. You can also imagine a situation in which, you know, you could create a real crisis. And if you're a master's student in machine learning, you're suddenly desperate for one of those 10 PhD seats at the University of Michigan because it's the highest probability chance of having direct access to that corpus. And if you don't have access to that corpus, there may be fields of study, and perhaps hundreds of fields of study, that are suddenly much harder to do without it.
There's an analogy between that and doing research based on access to a very expensive telescope. Not everybody who wants to reproduce your research is able to do it. They have to stand in line, maybe they have to pay, and they have to certainly do it through peer review all over again. But as far as possible, we want to facilitate reproducibility through open access. Open access fully implemented would not only remove price barriers, but permission barriers. So you don't need anybody's permission to get back at the data. And the people who do the research and then publish the results should provide open access to their text, summarizing what they did, their data, and open source for any software they used to analyze the data. If they can, they can't always, and that's a problem. But what we should start to understand as a community is that when they can't, we're actually interfering with reproducibility, and that's a problem.
So is the answer to this to essentially say, what's on the table in the settlement is crazy, it's unreasonable, you're already constructing a system to allow academics to retrieve information out of the system, you have the capacity to throttle them. So someone who's essentially coming in there and asking for a million queries a day, you can say, okay, now's time that we're going to review this. And either Google reviews it or they contract with someone to review it. But generally speaking, for the amateur researcher out there who isn't lucky enough to have a seat at Harvard or UMich or something along those lines, you make this openly accessible via a 10,000 query a day API or something along those lines, which has sort of become industry standard around a lot of these tools. Would that satisfy, not for the consumptive things that you're arguing for, but for the non-consumptive things that I'm arguing for, would that, with the possibility of expanding based on some sort of application, satisfy some of the open access questions?
I think it would. I think we have to deal with the fact that some big telescopes are very expensive and hard to get at. And the CERN Hadron Collider is a perfect example. Nobody's going to have access to that except people who can get through CERN's peer review filters. And they spend billions on this, and they're not going to let just anybody in. This, by the way, is one reason why people who do this experiment can essentially put them online without any peer review, because they've already gone through peer review just to have their hands on the machine. But if we accept that as valid research and we have no choice, then I think we can do the same with people who have limited access to commercially available databases. We can also hold out the hope that one day we can loosen the screws on access. But as long as this is all we've got, it's like saying this telescope is the only way to check the spectrum of this distant stellar object.
I mean, what's interesting about this is that you open up the possibility of essentially saying, here's the best telescope ever. It's actually very hard to get access to. You're going to have to go through the peer review. We'll give you a trickle of access. We'll give you the 10,000 a day. If you want to use the slightly smaller reflector, Harvard has now taken the step because we think we're within our rights to do it. We're just doing public domain material. Yeah, it doesn't help you beyond 1923. But prior to 1923, it gives you an enormous document collection. For some tasks, this is going to be incredibly helpful. And we're going to throw this open under a more liberal open access policy. It might be a really interesting way to sort of see what experiments get run against both of them, whether there's something to be said for the more limited utility, but the broader access, whether that ends up becoming more popular in some ways because there are fewer hoops to jump through.
I think cutting-edge researchers will always want access to the bigger database, even at a higher price, because it allows deeper discoveries, while the community, as opposed to the individual researcher, wants reproducibility. And that means the less expensive, more limited database.
Is that a different question, but I think it also comes on our side here. Are we seeing like a kind of Elsevier business model going on here in relationship what Google wants to do in the future in terms of having this content as a platform?
Bob Darnton worries that that's what's going on.
Okay, yeah, so did the lawyer in the presentation said something? I was not in the attention or how you
I've talked to Google about this.
In the future, because if we impede things right now, like since the beginning, or actually, let's put it out there, since the non-consumptive concept is already so restrictive, how do you see this in the future in terms of universities being dependable on Google?
I guess we have to distinguish access to the whole corpus for research purposes from access to full text for human consumption, because the latter is price. You can buy a copy of an individual book, a university can subscribe to the corpus, but apparently the research access is free if you're one of the approved research institutions. So whether the Elsevier problem comes up depends on which one we're talking about. Bob Darnton is worried that access to the text for human consumption will be an Elsevier type problem, because Google will essentially have a monopoly, or the registry will have a monopoly, and there'll be almost no constraint on their ability to raise prices because they're a monopoly. The only constraint would be competition, but nobody really would digitize all this stuff over again. So running without competition, they could keep checking up the price. Now, Google's answer to that objection is that there is, in fact, a constraint on the price because they are selling consumer editions of each of these works individually. And they're doing that at something like a market price.
And providing a free service of 20%.
Yes. There'll always be a 20% snippet available. So that's really the only assurance coming back from Google. They said this
well,
is
there are the limitations in the settlement itself that has to guarantee broad access.
Yes, but that clause is balancing at the other clause that says the registry has to maximize revenue or maximize profit. So that's a scary phrase when you're not thinking about anything else. But Google says in the whole package, you see that maximizing profit is done in a system of other constraints. For example, selling access to consumers. We don't really know how that's going to turn out. But it's enough to worry a smart person like Bob Doctor that it is an Elsevier problem in the making. It's a recipe for another monopoly that could jack up prices.
I mean, as far as the non-consumptive stuff goes, I think there's a lot of this has to do with how paranoid you're going to be on reading this. I think the paranoid read essentially says you've created a utility which probably has a value much, much greater than 20 years worth of revenue of selling access to orphan works. If this allows you to corner the translation market, this is worth tens of billions of dollars a year one. And it's a market that actually has the potential to expand radically beyond that because this problem of a polyglot internet is just going to be a bigger and bigger problem for everybody. The other way to say this is to say they've thought really, really long and hard about how you price out individual books, how you share revenues, how you deal with orphan works. This is sort of being set aside because if they didn't offer some provision of access to researchers, guys like me were going to go nuts. So instead, they put a provision which we're now sort of trying to figure out, do we like this? Do we not like this? Do we want to try to maximize the utility of this? Or do we want to fight against this and try to get something better out of this? One way to read that is to say they don't necessarily think there's all that much of a market for selling access to an API key to the full collection. For the simple reason that most academic research groups aren't going to scrape together $25,000, $50,000 to buy their API key. They're essentially going to refuse and either develop some other probably less satisfactory model around archive.org or around whatever Harvard scanned from all of this. And find another way to do the research. And to a certain extent, if something else becomes the default corpus, other people will work on it because it's the default corpus, even if it's not very good, right? I mean, the problem we have with the EuroParl stuff is that everything you translate ends up coming out sounding like a European parliamentarian, which is a real problem in machine translation, right? I mean, most of us don't speak like European parliamentarians, thank God. So, I mean, I've been trying to sort of look at this and essentially saying, well, maybe what they're trying to do is this is a company still dominated by computer science PhDs. Maybe they're trying to figure out in a way to keep their lawyers happy, a way to throw guys like me a bone. Let's figure out how to maximize the benefits of that bone. But if you take the other stance on this, the paranoid stance on this essentially says, hey, we're going to get away with murder. We've come up with this carefully structured settlement to pay a modest amount of money to a trust that may or may not be able to have it, pays a nominal amount to publishers, but what we're really going to do is we're going to monetize the hell out of the giant data set that we've created. I can see from people nodding knowingly that a lot of people here are fairly paranoid about Google.
Why would they establish a research purpose at all? They have it already.
I agree with you. I'm not hugely paranoid.
The library rights and obligations section of the settlement, it sounds to me, when I read this, that the libraries wanted this and they got it out of the negotiation. And that it's governed, its auditing is all from the publisher's point of view. All the auditing is to prove that you didn't read anything. The paranoia that this would violate copyright. So I don't know where the paranoia really is coming from. It looks like to me this is the good news of the settlement, is the research purpose.
Yeah,
and the choice of who gets it in here is the libraries. It says here the libraries, in consultation with Google. But the libraries did come first there in the choice. So it sounds to me like the library community lobbied this and wanted it. Now we think it's a bad thing.
If you look at the various programs in the settlement, they have different levels of caps on them. There are some things that are very heavily restricted and they can't be very free. in terms of how they wind up. The research corpus is one of the least restrictive pieces of it. It's one of the ones that the publishers have really put the fewest constraints on and could be the most useful. There are things in here that you think, well, the library's digital copies can't be used for very much, and that's too bad. But the research corpus really has a lot of amazing uses.
It looks to me like if the library said, we want the digital copies, we'd like to data mine them. You can't do that. So they came up with the idea of the research corpus. That's what it looks like when I read this without wanting to be paranoid about it.
But that's not how you're saying it.
It just feels like, again, this is our discomfort at not having done it. Because, you know, had we done it, you wouldn't be creating, the opportunity for Google to be evil. Because even if they're not being evil, there's this opportunity over there to corner the translation part, the machine translation market or something. And also B, you know, again, using the Hathi example, it's governed by a group. It's governed by a bunch of libraries. So you can assume that it's not going to try to further a digital divide. And this feels like, wow, there's going to be these two places that are going to have this advantage. And that's just an enormous digital divide that makes us uncomfortable. I don't think anyone would argue that it's a bad thing to have access to this corpus. It's exciting and all of that. But it's that queasy feeling again of what does it do to imbalances that are already there.
That's but it sounds like if we... Perhaps the most tangible recommendation we've gotten out of this conversation is essentially to put a lever around this idea of replicability and essentially say that unless these two university centers are sufficiently open that, you know, anyone who is not obviously crazy or criminal can get access to this, we're going to end up with the telescope problem. And it seems really crazy to have a telescope problem on a digital resource.
Exactly.
So finding a way to do this, either through one of the university centers or through Google directly, where someone is offering sort of no questions asked 10,000 queries a day and the ability to scale up to something significantly more powerful, seems like a pushback or an ask around all of this. It still raises this interesting question that I think we have on the table here, which is, do we want to acknowledge that this is something that needs to be covered under licensing rather than something that we simply claim transformative academic fair use as long as it's a non-consumptive use with the reminder that it's not about copyright but about the contract having to do with access.
Well, there's that too, but you can't claim fair use for something unless you have access to it for use. And you don't have access to this corpus without Google's contractual gate.
Yep.
But you were asking originally, if Harvard wanted to be one of these research centers, what should it do? And what could we think about now that Harvard might do? This is one answer, one piece of the puzzle. It might say, anyone who does a large text mining or text analysis experiment using the corpus through Harvard must promise, or we as Harvard promise, to make the facilities available to reproduce that result for any team in the future. And they may want to put constraints on it, like reproduce it once. Because it may be very computationally intensive.
I have another question, which is, do people never go move between a research corpus and wanting to see it in a, you know, human readable way? Like, if I were a historian, I would think, oh, I would do some studies the way you're talking about, but I didn't want to see some of it. So then we have a problem, don't we, if we can't do that?
No, to tune all these algorithms, you're always going back and forth between human-readable text and algorithmically readable text.
I mean, would it be permitted to make people look at small sections of it? I imagine the word substantial is the limit there. So I think you could probably look at a paragraph to check context.
But one experiment you might imagine in the future is some kind of artificial intelligence that would try to understand the text. And that can only be verified with human readers. What does the text make of, what does the machine make of this? Or what's the machine's paraphrase of this article? Let's compare that to what I make of it. Or what other humans make of it. That requires reading it for understanding. That requires access for the purpose of reading it for understanding. And you can't get that under the research corpus clause of the settlement. You have to get it some other way, some conventional way.
There is a clause about it. You can do it as a reasonably necessary to carry out non-consumptive research. And for the viewers or challenges of the results of the research, to read protected material is reasonably necessary to analyze or verify such
results. Okay. Good.
But do you have the technical ability to do that, or do you have to then apply to Google to say, I've been using your research thing, and now I need to do this, and then they say, sorry, we don't consider that.
They haven't been very clear with us about what the access constraints are going to be, but the sense that we got was that you can write a bot that's going to take the text, not just a word vector of the text, not just a map reducing the text. You can have the text. What you can't do is then essentially publish research, which essentially says, we then read 400 pages of the text and concluded the following. What it has to be instead was, we trained our algorithms on full retrieval of all of this text, and now the algorithms do the following. So I don't think physical retrieval of the text is going to be that much of an obstacle, but I think, again, this is where a lot of this comes into play. If what we're getting out of this is not the sort of sinister, this is Google's secret plan to, you know, dominate the global economy, but this is actually Google essentially saying, look, our main problem has been the publishers. We wrote 120 pages to settle with them. We tried to write three fairly tight pages to keep the researchers happy. Let's now have a conversation about how we reassure everyone in these research things. We've raised a lot of questions here which actually would further that process, and a lot of things which I think come up as very legitimate objections to it. I do think there's this fun open question which comes into play almost every time you bring Google to the table, which is, do you think they're basically the good bunch of guys that I went to CS programs with, you know, hanging out at a really big institution, or do you believe that they are the next Microsoft crossed with IBM, crossed with AT&T, crossed with Satan itself? Or somewhere in between, which is probably the more likely outcome. But Phil, are we wrapping at this point?
We're about wrapping, you know. Okay. Take, walk slowly back, stretch a little bit, we'll reconvene in the big room for 25 minutes, half an hour or so, and it would be good enough to share the two or three or however many
we
most
have
amazing, tantalizing, coolest things that you guys have. That'd be awesome.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.